Please, pull up a seat and wind down. Was your sojourn on Rakenjima a pleasant one? The Witch of Miracles has invited you to a tea party. We hope you choose to attend.
Hello and welcome to a hidden tea party. My name is Courtney, I'm the Witch of Video Games, and these are my guests.
Hello.
Hi, I'm Jess, my pronouns are they, them, and I am really sorry to tell you that I still haven't solved the epitaph.
Fuck. After all these clues?
I know. I'm so ashamed.
Inza really likes Arecana.
No, fuck
you.
Stop it.
Fuck you. That's the sweet fish. That's done. That's enough.
And that's the sweet fish. And based on that, we now know. And that's it.
That's it. That's it. That's all we got. Bullshit. Hi, my name's Roman. My pronouns are they, them. And I've got a call out post to make.
Ooh.
Courtney, you never give people your pronouns.
Oh, shit. She, her. Fuck.
I just realised the people don't know how to refer to you.
Fuck. No, they can just call me by my full title at all times. How does that sound? Courtney the Witch of Video Games. I accept nothing else. She, her, though. Fuck, I always forget.
You always forget.
So am I going to have to retroactively edit the episodes to stick my pronouns in there? I'll do it.
I'm pretty sure that from, like, the context clues of us referring to you using she, her pronouns, people have probably sussed in. But you never know. You might have some, like, funky... You might be a she, they. People wouldn't know.
That's true. People wouldn't know. I am a she, her, though.
Yeah. God, what
Feel
a woman.
Feel free to cancel me.
Cancel me.
Woman.
Incredible. Anyway, speaking of women, we've read more of Hitvisual novel Lumineko.
Yes, we have read up to chapter 7. We've read up to and including chapter 7, The Frantic Golden Drama. So, if you're reading along with us, spoilers for up to that point. If you're not reading along with us, fuck you.
And that's that on that.
So, we start with Chapter 7, Erica Furudo, where we begin with you know, the family conference being set up.
Yeah, so the literally the first thing that happens in this chapter is George, Jessica, and Battler are talking. And Battler's like, oh yeah, Anja's sick, she's got a really bad diarrhea, like, ugh, and then starts talking about, you know, his little sister's diarrhea in some disgusting detail. And Jessica and George both basically punch him at once. And I was like, this should have been the reaction to all of the gross sexual stuff he said. We know they're capable of it, because they just did it.
Yeah. So I had read this section too quickly, and I thought he said, there's marshmallows that come out of girls' bottoms, and I would like to eat some. And I was like, one, Battler based for eating ass. Two, why the fuck are you saying it about your little sister? That's why they punched you. So I went back to double check what he said, and then realised that it was nothing of such nature. And of course, because why would they react like that to Battler being a sex freak?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, no, he just says, like, he says something gross, and then he's like, oh yeah, no, I forgot, like, only marshmallows come out of girls' butts, nothing else.
So he says, only marshmallows come out of girls' butts, nothing else, except in Anja's case, they've all turned to syrup, and that's what they punch him over.
Yeah. And I'm like...
Great.
I'm like, it's definitely not the most offensive thing Battle has ever said by a long fucking shot.
Mm-hmm. Or done.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Nutsy is being introduced to a Ronave and Gap, and you know, they're setting up
their
Kinzo scheme, keeping him in the study.
I think it's interesting in this bit that, because like, Natsui's also like talking to Genji, being like, right, please help Nanjo, because she's basically like, all the servants are great at lying. I'm worried about Nanjo. So now I'm like, ooh, I wonder if Nanjo slips at any point in the episodes we've already seen. Curious, not sure. Because he definitely seems uncomfortable, like in the bit where like Natsui says, like, right, we're gonna pretend Kinzo's still alive. He like goes along with it, but he looks uncomfortable.
He does.
Fair enough.
Yeah, fair enough. It's a bit fucked up, really. Especially like as you're a medical professional, being asked to like lie about the health of someone and pretend they're still alive must be a bit awkward.
Yeah.
Like if people find that out, they're probably not going to trust you as a doctor anymore.
Yeah.
But yeah, now I'm
he
wondering
could lose
whether
his medical any... license.
Yeah. But instead, he just dies.
That works too.
But yeah, I'm now wondering whether they're like, if you dig into Nanjo's dialogue and like from the earlier ones, whether there's anything he says that kind of gives it away. I haven't noticed anything.
Yeah, I mean, usually he's just shuffled off to have a nap.
Yeah,
so.
He doesn't say very much, which is probably good for him, to be honest.
That's probably Genji's like, Nanjo, go take a nap.
Yeah, it's like, Nanjo, just don't say anything and we'll be fine.
It does make me wonder about the like Nanjo accusations that you had for episode 3. I wonder if this information is helpful for any of that, but I'm too stupid to figure it out.
I think it's weird that if all of this is true, and that the theory that I had about like basically Genji and Kanon forcing everything after the first kind of twilight on Nanjo to orchestrate, why would they do that if they think he's the weakest link in the scheme?
Obviously, having the doctor on your side is very helpful, because then you can falsify autopsies.
Definitely. I feel like they wouldn't leave him by himself because they're worried about him doing this. So I don't know why, they would have done that.
Yeah, I don't think they did. I still don't know what happens, but I don't think... Nanjo was expected to orchestrate the Twilights. I think that's a Genji, Kanon, Shannon specific plan that actually nobody else is involved in.
It's possible that whilst Natsui thinks that Nanjo's not good at lying, that Genji and the servants don't agree. And that they've got their own separate thing going on, I guess.
Yeah, that's that also possible. I don't know.
Nanjo mastermind theory.
Yeah.
So we've got the usual stuff. It's raining. Maria's in the rose garden. But this time she is met by a new stranger on the island. And Genji reveals that a young girl who's slightly younger than Jessica washed up on the island after falling from a cruise ship.
Yeah. And like Nanjo, Kumasara and Shannon are looking after her. And like Natsui's like, what the fuck? What? This is making things weird and complicated. Just look after her. She's a guest now, I guess. Also, what I would love to say, because Kumasawa finds some of Jessica's old formal clothes and they dress her up, and so she's got this blue hair and she's got this little floral headpiece and this big fancy poofy dress and stuff, and she turns up and they're all like, oh, how's she gonna react being in this house full of completely new posh people? And then they're all like, oh, thank fuck, she's also posh.
Yeah.
Because she's not fazed by it at all. And she's like, oh, yeah, I have manners. I know what to say. And they're all like, oh, thank fuck, we don't have a commoner with us. And I'm like, dear.
So we're finally introduced to perhaps the greatest fictional character ever written, Erica Ferrudo.
Allow me to introduce myself. My name is Erica Ferrudo. My deepest apologies for disturbing you all like this. I am most grateful for your warm welcome, even though I am an uninvited guest.
What a legend. I just... Rikishi kind of popped off with this one, I'm not gonna lie.
I had, at this point, no real thoughts about her. I was like, okay, interesting.
Yeah. We get some very important red truth, which is
this
that,
was when started game duty.
Yeah, she's not on any of the previous game boards. Yes. So you don't have to worry about Erica for any ones prior to this one. She's the detective, and she's not the culprit, because the detective is not the culprit.
Nox is seventh.
Nox is seventh. But Lambda does say that there was an exception clause in the original game for this. However, there isn't in this game, so Erica Ferrudo does not kill him.
When they say the original game, do they mean episode one?
They mean all the prior games when Beato was game mastering.
Right. So what is the exception clause? Like, the exception is to...
They don't say.
Right, okay.
But... They don't say what the clause is, but there is apparently an exception clause where the detective in the previous games, which was Battler, could have been the culprit.
Ooh, I missed that.
Either that's like Battler has killed someone over the course of the games, or this is to do whatever his fucking sin is.
It doesn't necessarily mean Battler was the culprit, it just means Battler could have been the culprit. Ryukishi throwing a bone to all those Battler culprit theory people.
Yeah, maybe it's like there's one instance where he doesn't have a good alibi. I think there's probably quite a few instances where he doesn't have an alibi, to be honest. In episode 4, for instance, I'm pretty sure he doesn't have an alibi for Maria. Because they're the last two people alive, supposedly.
Don't feel like you have to revise all your theories with Battler culprit. But if you want to, this doesn't disprove that.
Yeah. The really important bit, I feel like, about Erica's introduction is Burncastle says in the meta world that she has put herself as a piece on the game board to serve as the detective, which makes a lot of sense because Erica looks exactly like Burncastle, but also is really interesting.
So this is going to become more apparent, but like, Erica is not directly Burncastle. She is her own person, but she's like serving Burncastle.
Yeah, I mean, like, they're not identical, but they're similar enough that you're like, okay, this is a piece that Burncastle
also
has. Like,
her name is a parody of one of the characters in Higurashi,
right?
Rika Furude, Erica Ferrudo.
Right. Yeah.
They're very different, though.
Burncastle says, quote, "With an incompetent like you as the main character piece, the game wouldn't go anywhere," which is like simultaneously my favorite and least favorite lines so far. It's my favorite line because it's true, and also because it means the game will go somewhere now. It's my least favorite because it means the game wasn't fucking going anywhere in the past four games, and I really was starting to feel like the past
it
four
went
games
some places.
I feel
not
like
very
the
fast,
past
I'll give
four
you
games could have been way more helpful and interesting if Erica had been there the whole time.
Potentially.
Yeah, I feel like things might have moved a bit quicker with Erica around, let's just say that.
I'm assuming that they will be moving a lot quicker once now Erica is around.
Well, as we discovered, six people died and Erica apparently had a cult pretty quick.
Yeah.
Yes, I think it's an interesting one from the position of the family to have an outsider there who they can be pretty certain isn't party to any of the house shenanigans, basically, and is, if not impartial, then, like, trustworthy, at least from the sense that she probably didn't orchestrate any of the plans that go on, because that's not really something they've had before. Like, there have been people that are like, oh, well, it's not going to be Maria because she's 9, but I'm like, she's still involved in everything. Like, she can still be manipulated by other people and used in plans and stuff, whereas because this character is completely new, like, it's fairly certain that she's not actually involved in any of it. Yeah, so I'm interested in what the dynamic will be moving on with her.
Natsuhi gets some full confirmation from Genji that Erica's story checks out.
Yeah, she was like on a pleasure boat or something and she fell off the back of it. They're still like, why was a fucking pleasure boat out in the typhoon? But hey ho. I do have actually a question here, because regarding the typhoon, originally we were thinking like, oh, the family didn't change the date of the conference because they wanted to keep people trapped on the island over the typhoon, because Kinzo wanted his murder ritual to happen. Obviously, he's dead. The Natsuhi and Kraus don't actually want the family there for as long as possible. They want to get rid of them, because the longer they're there, the more likely they are to discover that Kinzo's dead. So why the fuck didn't they rearrange the conference?
So I think because the other family members had the plan of exposing Kinzo, they didn't want to delay it. Like, they were worried that, like, maybe they'd, like, pull stuff if they gave them more time. That's my theory. That it was probably more the insistence of Ava and Rudolph.
Slash, maybe they thought they'd be super suspicious if they were like, let's move the date back. I feel like it would have been less suspicious overall to say, let's do it next weekend when there's not a typhoon. Yeah. Rather than keep the entire family on the island for like an extra 24 hours.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, a really bad time to be on a pleasure cruise during a typhoon. We cut to dinner and Erica is fitting in very well, naturally.
Yeah, they're like, ooh, how's she gonna do it? Are her manners gonna be okay? And she's like, actually, I'm gonna school you all in manners because I'm also Richie Rich. And they're like, oh, and it's kind of really grim.
There's a joke where Erica, like, is talking about how she prefers to eat stuff with chopsticks. And she's like, there's nothing that you can't eat with chopsticks. I fucking love chopsticks. And then they're like, the next course is gonna be soup. And I was like screaming and clapping and pointing at the screen like, it's the soup joke. It's the soup
yes.
joke.
Yes. Beatrice's here. Soup time.
Yeah.
Soup time.
But then also they go into basically the fact that because Erica knows all of the, like, the manners and stuff, she'd have known that the next course was going to be soup in the, like, fancy-ass menu thing. So, like, it was a setup, basically, for her to do yeah. the, oh,
she's doing
no.
a bit.
She's doing a bit. She's... And I'm like, is this what rich people do for fun?
So they talk about, she at some point is talking about how, like, oh, I felt like being too natural at this was setting everybody on edge, and so by fucking up I've actually, like, made the atmosphere, like, calmer because everybody's, like, less on edge now.
Yeah, well, everyone is, like, laughing and having a good time, which is weird to see because they don't do that in this game.
No. Including me, I will confess. I did like the soup joke. I did find the soup joke quite funny.
It was quite funny. And then they're all like, Jessica, she's trying to steal your thunder. You're the successor or whatever. Like,
Jessica,
you're going to be
so
the next
mad.
Child who inherits this. And so, like, let's see your manners. And she, like, sits up really stiffly and, like, tries to eat. And they're all like, lol.
I'm like, yeah, okay.
You're bad at this.
Bully Jessica corner. Got it.
Yeah, Jessica's not having a fun time.
She is not.
But everyone else really is. They're all having a fucking great time. They're all like, let's not even do the conference yet. Let's just go to bed, do it tomorrow. Like, we're all chill now. I will point out there was a moment here which I thought might be relevant for later in alibis and stuff, where it's confirmed that Goda and Kumasawa are the two servants taking the shift in the guest house in this game board. I don't know why that was mentioned, but I presume that it'll be useful because it was mentioned.
It will be useful. Erica notices the epitaph on the way out from dinner, and they go back to the guest house and talk about it.
Yes. And I was like, yes, Erica's gonna solve the epitaph for me. I won't have to do any work anymore.
So Erica doesn't even start by focusing on the solution. She instead is, like, trying to work out why Kinzo would display it.
Yeah.
And comes up with the theory that it's because he doesn't want Kraus to inherit his fortune. He wants someone else from the family because he didn't put it in, like, a newspaper or anything. Mm-hmm. So he obviously is restricted to family members.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, if he wanted Kraus to inherit everything, he wouldn't have put up this epitaph to choose the next successor.
Yeah, and she's also like, and it's a thing, you know, rich people get people to do tests and stuff to get, like, money and power and stuff. And Jessica's there like, no.
Yeah, Jessica's not pleased about her dad being undermined.
Yeah, I don't know why. I don't know why she gives a shit, to be honest. It's not like she wants to be successor or anything.
We don't really ever get much thought of, we get a lot of stuff about Jessica and Natsuhi, but not much about Jessica and Kraus.
I get the impression that Kraus probably isn't particularly involved, and
probably too busy, you know, buying fake stocks,
buying avocados,
buying avocados.
Also, it's at this point that I realise that Erica is just kind of a mishmash of every detective in everything ever, because she makes a reference to her little grey cells. I was like, oh, hello, Poirot.
Yeah,
Poirot's here. And just in general, the kind of showboaty style of everything is very like Golden Age detective. Everything's kind of a game. She'll turn up and solve everything just for the fucking fun of it.
I like to describe Erica as like a detective like stereotype taken to its logical extreme.
Yeah.
Where she's like insane mystery solver at the cost of having like does not care about feelings at all, because she's like, she's full facts, don't care about your feelings
fully. Oh god, oh no, that makes her like George. But yeah, like she has like her catchphrase essentially, which she says multiple times, is like, simply by the existence of the epitaph in that place, this level of reasoning is possible for Ferrudo, Erica. What do you think? And she's just like constantly like, yeah, like all of this reasoning has come from the fact she saw the epitaph and it was in that place. And then like everything she says, like she thinks about it later, she's just like, I just saw it there. And look how much I've thought of because of it. Just like, all right, you little shit.
She's just like, suddenly all the ego in the room is being monopolized by
adults don't really know what to do with that, because usually they're the ones with the egos and they're just like, this small child is stealing our thunder so massively.
It is a lot of fun to watch Erica just absolutely kick the family members around the room. She's like solving the epitaph, she's dominating the room at the family dinner, and I'm like, it's fun to watch somebody kick back at them.
Yeah, I think like Erica, like by herself in this moment, is completely fucking insufferable, but because the people she's owning with it are the Ashuramias, it's great.
So we go back to the meta world, and Lambda Delta and Burncastle take Battler to the Sea of Fragments, which is what Lambda Delta used to solve the epitaph, which is basically just like all the possibilities of previous and future games.
Yeah, so it's basically the Let's Play archive that we've been using, but with other bits we haven't seen.
Yeah. So she said she only had to look through a few hundred to work it out, but we mostly focus on
the ones we've seen,
the stuff that went down in episode 3.
And I was slightly upset by this, right? Because they basically go through everything that like Rosa and Kyrie and like Ava said when Ava was trying to solve the epitaph and things, and like make, and Erica kind of explicitly states some assumptions you can make based off those, and I was like, this is great, but I did this and I came up with those answers, and I would love for you to give me something more than that. Because like, because they go over, you know, like the river is metaphorical, the sweet fish is like a bit of a hint, it's a clue, but it's not as super important. It could have been substituted for something else, maybe. The place, like something is verifiable in a book in a library, because Ava went there, I was like, yeah, we knew that.
So this part was really funny to me, because Battler was like, fucking couldn't figure out what the book in the library was. And I was like, literally, I was sat in the room with my family at the time, and I like said out loud what I thought it was, which was very funny to me. Like I was, Battler was doing the Watson bit where he was slightly stupider than me, and I was doing the bit where I could figure it out, and I felt great. And then when I was proved right, I was really pleased.
Yeah, like I think we talked about it even maybe that we thought it was like something like a map or something, and yeah, and it is. And so I'm like, that's great, but that doesn't really give me any extra information, because we kind of suspected that.
Get some information that the key is probably a 6-letter word, and you use
which is
the
what
key
Kyrie said
on a 11-letter word.
Yeah, well, yes, kind of. They do talk about, so, Battler and Erica kind of work together to say that, like, if you're removing the 6 letters from the first Twilight from something, and by the time you get to the 9th Twilight, there are no letters left, as in, you know, no one gets left alive, then it will be an 11-character word if the second Twilight tear apart the two that are close means you just put a space in between, and a 13-character word if it means delete them. And I'm like, that's great. One thing that I have worked out, and I'm annoyed that this doesn't really feel like it helps anyway, but Rokkanjima is an 11-character word.
So it is an 11-character word.
It's an 11 one. Cool.
It's quadrillion.
Is quadrillion 11 characters?
Yes.
Yes, it is.
Ooh. Because I was thinking Rock and Jima is 11 characters and, interesting enough, the first syllable, rock, is the Japanese word for six.
Ooh, that's cool.
I just don't know how it's spelled, so it's probably not spelled the same, but I was wondering if that was anything. So I had to play around with, like, messing around with the characters, taking out certain ones and stuff, but, like, Rock and Jima, that's an awkward word. There's not a lot of stuff that fits with that. So I didn't come up with anything, basically. But then quadrillion's the same. What the fuck do you do with a Q?
Well, remember, you're probably removing six letters. Oh,
that's true. You're probably removing the Q in the first six, yes, I would assume. And because I was also... One of the questions I wanted to ask you, Courtney, right? And this is in relation to the tenth twilight, when it says you shall attain to the power of the Golden Land's treasures, which is, as you pointed out, Rowan, a really weird thing to say unless you're talking about something to the power of something else, like in maths. Courtney, can you confirm to me if in the Japanese system is quadrillion 10 to the power of 15 or 10 to the power of 24?
Give me a moment.
This was the weird question because I was like, if you know the answer to this, then it must be relevant. because the thing is that, like, a billion is different depending on whether you're in the UK or in America, because we do it differently. Quadrillion is the same, but I couldn't work out what kind of system, whether the system that the Japanese might use would be the British one or the American.
Okay, so I believe this game uses 10 to the 15.
Okay, thank you. So no, that means the number 15, then, I feel, is relevant, but I don't know to what. I don't know what we do with it. Out of interest, by the way, Rowan, if you put a space between the L's,
mm-hmm,
and don't actually delete anything else, lion is a four-letter word at the end, and I really feel like that could be something. Especially because there's lion statues at the chapel. I don't know what the first fucking word is. Because,
I'm going to give my last hint.
Okay.
The third twilight is relatively important.
What's the third twilight?
Yeah, so this is another thing they talk about in this one, is that Erica thinks it might be another anagram. The praise my noble... Well, I don't know if it's those who remain shall praise my noble name, or just praise my noble name. No idea. And I don't really know what we do with it.
I don't know. Anyone know what Adril is?
Yeah, Adril Lion. Adril Lion. Adil Lion. Rill Lion. These are all...
We'll
fantastic.
Be back in anagram mode.
Yes.
I think we need the six letters. I think we need to figure out what the fucking key is and what those six letters are that need to come out of the thing.
So are we presuming that you take the six letters out, you split the two that are close, which we're thinking of the L's, and then you do the third twilight. So what the fuck do you do with it? Praise my noble name. You put the word Beatrice in.
How many? B-E-A-T-R-I-C-E. Eight.
Okay, I said that that was going to be asking. I'm going to give one more. When thinking of my noble name, think about the person who wrote the epitaph.
Kinzo.
Five.
And, think about what you can do with the letters in what you're assuming is the 11-letter word.
I just realised that if you can make Kinzo's name into the anagram to make Zoink. It's the answer.
Zoink!
Now. I was also wondering, Courtney, whether you could confirm, you know, in the code, the mysterious 8-digit code that we get scrawled on the door, and that's the code to the small Golden Land, the 07151129. Yeah. Can you confirm whether that's relevant to the epitaph? Okay. I was trying to do that stuff with that. But that's at least one thing out the way.
Yeah. It's relevant for something else, but it's not the epitaph.
What the fuck are you going to do with the Z? Like,
I've given you so many hints.
I feel like you have to stop now. I feel, but
yeah, I feel like any more and it's gonna be too easy. So,
but we might need to think about this off pod more, because nothing is immediately coming to mind. Is what I will say.
Well, regardless, Erica moves to the library to find an atlas to solve the epitaph, and then we cut to Natsuhi. Who is trying to work out what her next move is. The witches and demons around her say that, you should change the plan. We should have Kinzo leave his study because we're not going to be able to withstand a siege.
Yeah, they're basically like, this plan ain't gonna fucking work. And they also mention this, oh, it's a fucking good job Erica arrived, isn't it? Because she's really taken the focus off Kinzo for a bit.
Yeah. She got everyone to leave the mansion, go to the guest house.
Yeah, like, if she hadn't been there, Kinzo might have been fucking discovered already. And Beatrice, like Natsui's version of Beatrice, also mentions, like, oh, I wonder if the man on the phone who threatened Natsui is also going to turn up. Like, because she mentions that Burncastle, unlike Kinzo, likes Eastern things. So we've got the East first West thing going on again. Eastern things like Shogi, which is a game apparently where you're allowed to, like, mid-game put new pieces on the board. Which I think is what she's arguing that Erica is.
Also, we talk about, what do they call it, mating shogi, where the one player doesn't have a king, and instead it's a game about what the player with the king trying to last as long as they can without their king being taken.
Yeah, it's basically just a kind of a chase then.
Yeah, which is what they say that Nazhi's playing at the moment, with the king being Kinzo being...
And I kind of assumed, like, this would be the moment where Natsui comes up with the plan to kill people. Because that's sure one way to get people to stop worrying about Kinzo, is to start fearing for their lives. But she doesn't suggest that out loud, if that is what she's thinking. Because instead, Gap turns up and is like, I think you should pretend Kinzo's just gone missing right now. And, like, Natsui's like, that's such a fucking stupid idea, because they'll know that that confirms, basically, to them that he's dead. And it's like, yeah, but there won't be any proof.
this is the scene that I came up with. My Gap is, like, all the places in the mansion that you can hide shit theory, because I was like, Gap is also the forest.
Ooh.
Then we cut back to Battler and Erica, who have solved the epitaph.
I hate this. I was like, oh, we're going to get more stuff about how they're solving the epitaph, and then they just do it off screen again.
Because they can't give it to us.
You're being blueballed again.
Yeah, I know, really. They do give us a few hints from here, in the sense that they're like, yeah, we're solving the epitaph. We're right at the end now. They're out in the woods in the rain, which I don't know whether it denies the fact that it could be the chapel, because they're not, like, they haven't got right to the very end. But it certainly makes it seem less likely, which upsets me.
So there's a moment at the very beginning of this scene where Battler says something like, gouge the foot and kill. And then we hear like a stone moving noise. And then he's like, oh my God, it is easy once you know the answer, Erica. Thank you so much for helping me. And I'm like, I feel like this confirms Jess's theory that all the twilights is how you get into the... Like, if it was the chapel, all the twilights are how you get into the chapel without use of the key.
I would love that to be true. I don't know if it is, but obviously, like, they aren't going to fucking show us where it is, so it's going to be vague. Another thing that they do say is they do find a physical lock.
Yes.
That has now been uncovered.
Yes.
In quotes. And it doesn't really tell us any more than that, but there is some kind of actual physical lock involved somewhere.
Interesting.
And I don't know what we do with that, really.
As they open up the thing, Battler sees Kinzo Battler sees like a ghost of Kenzo. Yes. And basically imagines him talking to Battler. Kenzo doesn't actually say anything. Battler just imagines him. But as he imagines, what he imagines Kenzo saying is like marveling at the fact that it's Battler that sold the epitaph. Kenzo says, quote, "Battler of all people, that Battler," which I'm taking as a point to two Battler theory.
Yeah, interesting. So. One thing I do love about all of this is that people's just being like, really? Fucking Battler? Wow. Really? Like, love
that. I mean, to be fair, we do get confirmation at this point that he was apparently being controlled by Burncastle.
Yeah, Burncastle's like, I make you so clever when I'm controlling you. Maybe you should let me control you all the time.
Yeah, and he's like, wow. But yeah, that's hilarious.
Prior to this, we get an interesting reveal from Erica. Huh. Which I know Rowan has been very excited for us to talk about.
Yes.
Trigger warning for some language around sexual assault, although it's only metaphorical. Erica refers to herself as an intellectual rapist who enjoys exposing things people try to hide. This is a direct translation. They did not take any liberties with this.
She says, I will make all opponents surrender, no matter who they are. That is my sole pleasure. And I'm like, this is grim.
Yeah, basically this is like the reveal that Erica sucks. Although, yeah. Like, if you've been following the game, you were probably already aware of that.
But yeah, like, she says multiple times when people are asking about the epitaph, she's like, I don't give a shit about the money. I'm not here to steal your money. I just basically want to prove that I'm better than you all. Yeah. And solve the riddle.
And also, she's like, specifically like, wants to get back at Jessica because she interrupted her, and so she's like, won't it be funny when she wakes up and finds out that Battler's the successor instead of her dad?
So yeah, and she's like, basically like, oh, I'm gonna do my thing, I'm gonna expose everything that's going on here, and then I'm just gonna watch the fallout, because that's her fucking ideal fun, apparently.
Yeah, she takes joy in, like, fucking the legend. Power of doing this, and she doesn't really care about the consequences. She just doesn't care about taking responsibility for her actions. She's just going to keep pushing until the riddle gives way.
Yeah.
And, like, she doesn't care. She keeps being like, I'm just going to keep pushing until it gives in. And I'm just like, this is horrifying. My concern with this is, once again, I am pointing at Ryukushi. This is a child. I know that I talked to Courtney about this previously, and Courtney said that she was 17, which, like, I was completely shocked by, because I honestly thought that she was slightly older than Maria. And I know that it's probably like partially a quirk of the redesigned sprites, but you look at Erica's sprites and she's got a very round face, she's got quite chubby cheeks, and her head in proportion to her body is quite large, which that's all things that you use to make that look like a child. If you are thinking that she's like around the same age as Jessica, older than Jessica, like, you look at Jessica's sprite, okay, I'm not even going to, like, touch the topic of chest size, because, like, that's a whole minefield, and, like, I'm willing to accept that some people just have small boobs. But Jessica is dressed quite formally, quite old, because she's got this, like, suit going on. The size of Jessica's head in proportion to her body is that of an adult. And also, she's got quite a, like, an angular face. She's still got these huge anime eyes, but she's got an adult's face rather than a pudgy child's face. There's a certain sprite of Erica where she's like turned slightly away from the camera and you can just see she's got this like huge childlike face, and it gives me the ick, because I'm like, knowing everything that I do already about this piece of media and the way it's already treated its like child-coded characters, to have like someone who reads as a child be like, I'm a fucking rapist, is like disgusting to me.
Yeah, it was quite the fucking choice of words as right? well. Like,
so like there's several ways that this could be done better. Like, Erica could not be a minor. Erica could not look like she's 12. Also, you could use a slightly less extreme word than rapist. I understand that this is supposed to be making Erica seem creepy, but you could use a word like voyeur, which still has like quite sexual connotations even. It's still quite creepy without being like, this person is like a criminal intellectually. Yeah. Like, I just...
Yeah, this happened and I was like, ooh.
There's so many aspects of this that I think are like icky, but not in the way that the book wants you to feel icky about it. Like,
possibly
they want you to feel like Erica is a creepy character, but I don't think her like childishness is part of what's supposed to be upsetting about the like being an intellectual rapist part of it. Like that,
yeah,
that is grim to me. I was not pleased to hear like this. She looks so young, and I know that is partially to do with the like redesigned sprites. I know that's not entirely Ryukushi, but holy shit.
I would argue as well, because I did Google this earlier, that the non-PS3 sprite for her, I feel like actually looks younger.
Interesting. Let me have a look.
Because she, like, it gives her an even rounder little face.
I was willing to cut it a bit of slack because I know that the Burncastle and Lambda Delta ones are like, there's debate over to whether or not they look like children, but you're right. Why is she looking like that?
It's really funny because I'd say she has quite an angular face in the Ryukishi sprites, but then I guess what?
I guess.
Maybe it's the Pachinko sprites. Maybe that's the best Erica sprite.
I wish she looked 17, and there's so many decisions that they could have made to make her look 17. Like, I know that the outfit, like, 17-year-olds can wear whatever the fuck they want clothing-wise. I'm not saying, like, oh, she should be in a 17-year-old outfit. It doesn't help, but...
I mean, the in-store excuse is it's Jessica's old clothes.
Yeah, so it is. It's clothes meant for somebody younger, but then they also didn't have to do that.
Yeah!
Yeah, they didn't. That is a conceit that the author came up with.
Like, I'm willing to put a pin in the clothes as, like, I could reason those away. There are so many other visual cues that are present across both sprites, actually. Once I've looked at the original sprite, I'm like, this is... Why did you have to make this character look like a child? Like, she's a fun character, she's interesting, she's well-designed. It could have been an adult. This person could have been, like, in her 20s.
So I'm going to say there is a reason as to why she looks like this. Because she's directly based on a character who's estimated to be around 11, 12 from Higurashi.
Oh, yes.
We don't have exact Higurashi ages.
We're like, it's Higurashi's fucking fault again.
Sin of the father, Higurashi, Rika Furude looking like... She looks older than Rika Furude, at least. Low bar, but you know.
Yeah,
I was going to say, you know what makes it better? You know what makes this shit better? Oh, I'm just going to blame Higurashi. Like, yeah, no, Higurashi well known for not being a nonce book. Like, I don't know that that makes it better. She does look older than Rika. What the fuck? Why is the second thing... Oh, no. Why is the second thing that comes up her in a frilly swimsuit?
Close the Google. Don't do this to yourself.
She is 11. She does have an age. Yeah, Rika Furude is 11.
It's just such a set of circumstances that are so icky. It's like, this character could have been an adult and it would have been fine.
Yes, but then she wouldn't have looked like Rika Furude.
And you know what? I'm willing to sacrifice that.
Yeah.
If you wanted to give her enough clues to look like Rika Furude, like, you could still give her the blue hair and shit. She just doesn't have to look like a kid.
I think it works because it's creepy in a intended way. And also, I think it fits Erica as a character. I don't think she'd hold back on using language like that.
Yeah.
From the way it's consistent with her characterization. I think it perfectly introduces, because this is the first kind of reveal, like the explicit reveal, that Erica sucks.
Yeah.
And I think it's a really good way of immediately dropping into the reader, like, yeah, this is not a good person.
Like,
yeah, it's an interesting one as well, having the detective character be someone who's kind of this reprehensible as well.
Yeah.
Umineko paving the way for BBC Sherlock.
Yeah, apparently.
Yeah, Stephen Moffat probably played Umineko. No, he didn't, because otherwise BBC Sherlock would be good.
I just took so much fucking psychic damage from everything you said there. Ow.
Incredible.
Like, yeah. I don't have a massive issue. Like, it made me uncomfortable. I think it's designed to. I don't have a massive issue with her using the term rapist itself. I think there are other better terms that could have been used that would have had the exact same effect. I think you could make this seem creepy without needing to do that. My issue is with that paired with, like, the character design. It just, it's yet another point to Ryukyushi as a nonce in, like, a damning pile of evidence in a way that, like,
it's quite the combo,
frames this moment as something that's more than just we're making this creepy. In isolation, perhaps I could reason my way out of this, but in combination with everything that I know about Higurashi and everything that I know about Ryukyushi and everything I've seen so far from this book, I'm like, what a fucking choice! What a fucking choice!
What a choice.
If it helps, she's later drawn with breasts. If from that way.
Why would that help, Courtney?
It doesn't help! I wish this character was designed to be 25. If this character was a 25-year-old and looked like it, we wouldn't be having this conversation. I wish she looked 17, because she doesn't look 17. She doesn't... I keep saying, like, oh my god, she looks like she's 3. She doesn't look extremely young, but I wish this wasn't a minor. I really wish this wasn't a minor.
I feel like if you told me she was 13, I'd be like, sure.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a creepy moment. Could have been an adult.
Yeah.
Could have been a fucking adult.
Because this is, I'm just here like, oh yeah, this is fairly tame, you know, anime age bullshit. No one really looks the correct age.
I hate that this is normalized. I hate that this is normal to you guys. You're like, oh, she looks like 13. That's normal. And I'm like, ha!
Yeah, I said, I was just like, okay, good. They didn't put her in like a two-piece swimsuit.
It's on the fucking floor. Come on, you guys.
And the other one is, I'm like, oh, well, at least she didn't say some other things anime 13. Honestly, intellectual rapist is pretty pretty low down on the things that anime children have been made to say.
Yeah.
What the fuck? Holy shit.
Hey, hey, remember, I watched like 3 episodes of Kill la Kill, so after that I was like... That's where the bar is.
Oh, thank you for reminding me that Kill la Kill exists.
Ugh. Yeah. So I'm like, anime girl calling herself an intellectual rapist, pretty low down on my list.
Yeah, I was introduced to Loveless by someone who was like, this was the first anime I ever saw, and I was forced to watch the first 3 episodes, and I was like, and you continue to watch anime after this. Like, it's like 14-year-old cat boy gets groomed by 21-year-old. It's fucking grim. And
oh god, and let's not get started on fucking Cardcaptor Sakura.
Why do you keep saying names of pieces of media? Why is there more?
There are so many.
Yeah, I just got reminded of Cardcaptor Sakura, where like a like 10-year-old is dating her teacher.
Yeah, so this is a problem. As established.
At the beginning of this episode, I was like, I feel like I should probably have more uses on this podcast than just being horrified about nonce shit. But you know what? Someone's got to do it. It's honest work. Jesus Christ.
Yeah, and to be honest as well, like, I don't know how much of it as well is like, because it's like so fucking normalized in a lot of anime media. I don't know how much of like what gets put in is just like, oh yeah, well, this is an anime trope, so we do this, like, without any other thought put into it. And how much of it is like, let's be pedophile on main. But either way, doesn't stop being very damaging.
The thing that horrifies me most is that you guys are just like, yeah, this is normal. Like, that's the thing that's scary to me, is I...
Maybe this is where we compile a call-out post for Ryukushi.
If Ryukushi has 10 haters, I am one of them. If Ryukushi has one hater, it's me. If Ryukushi has no haters, I'm dead.
We should probably continue with the reading.
No!
It's been some time.
Okay.
Have fun editing this, Rowan! I'm so glad I didn't have to... Actually, no. If I was editing this, I'd cut all this out. I'm sorry. This would be lost to the cat box.
I feel like we've gone on quite a bit about it, but I do still want to raise it because it's...
Yeah, no, I think it's important to raise. I think we have slightly gone round in circles.
It's okay. You all wanted to talk about Kill la Kill, and I'm not going to stop you.
No, I don't want to talk about Kill la Kill! Anyway, I'm excited for in a couple of episodes where we do this discussion again with a new character.
No.
Oh, God. Oh, no.
Berserk readers do not interact. Anyway, back to the...
Kill la Kill readers. Kill la Kill watchers do not interact.
Me making a card, but it's just every piece of media ever.
Yeah. Do not interact
Sailor
with
Moon,
me.
Sailor Moon readers do not interact.
If you have watched anime or a TV show or read a visual novel, fuck off.
If you have consumed media, do not speak to me. I wish only to bash rocks together and stare at the moon.
Yes. Yes.
All right.
Yeah, so this is like the moment where Battler is like, ah, shit. I might have got carried away with this whole solving the epitaph thing. Because he's like, he was like, oh yeah, well, I'll just split the money and give the successorship back to Kraus. Like, that's fine. And then realizes that it's probably not going to be that simple. And that now that they've solved the epitaph, he can't unsolve the epitaph. And that, yeah, this is going to cause like some massive fallout that he won't be in control of. And he's like, uh-oh.
Yeah, and the family is like, okay, so Kraus is obviously not pleased.
Before we go into their reactions, there is one other thing when they're in the scene still trying to solve the end of it, where, like, because Kinzo's, they're silhouetted in the woods, one of the things he does is he points at something, and Battler looks at it and realizes it is the signpost to the Golden Land, which he doesn't clarify in any way, but he points out to Erica, and Erica says, oh yeah, it was facing a different way before. I don't know what that means, but I feel like when we get further on in kind of epitaph stuff, we will. So I've highlighted that bit. Courtney's doing eyebrows, which means, yeah, it's definitely important.
I said I'd stop giving you hints.
Yeah.
Kinzo really likes her. So we find the gold. Said everyone's fully freaking out. So Natsu's still in the study, and then Ava starts banging on the door, saying like, "Dad, Dad, someone's found your gold. It's Butler." And naturally, Natsu starts freaking out because Kinzo's dead. And how is she going to get through this? So she calls Kraus and gets him to sort of pry Ava away from the door so she can slip out. And they're like, Dad is sleeping. Never disturb him in his sleep. What's this about gold, by the way?
And they start like having a bit of a physical fight. Like Kraus like grabs Ava really hard and she's in pain. And it's Genji who like breaks up and is like, right, everyone get out of here right now.
Yeah. Genji apparently was very surrogate father for them.
Makes
Couldn't
sense.
Say Kinzo's husband. So,
Kinzo Kuel confirmed.
Kinzo Kuel.
Kinzo Kuel real.
Kinzo Kuel real. So as Kraus and Natsui are coming out of the door, I think this is where like manifested Kinzo discovers about the epitaph being solved. And he has like his little aside in the spirit world with Beatrice and Vigilia, where they're like talking about like people having to like fade away or whatever because whether he's going to leave now and whether Beatrice is going to leave Natsui's service and stuff. And Beatrice says, "You're a fallen angel with one of its wings plucked off, aren't you? Just leave the other wing as a parting gift and go." Which I can't make sense of currently, but feels like witch lore for Kinzo.
Well, I mean, it's talking about the one-winged eagle, I think.
Yeah, I just assumed. I was like, I don't... It feels... It felt significant. I screenshotted it. I wanted to bring it up. That's all I got for you.
Fair enough. Beatrice says she's going to keep serving Natsuhi until the end of the family conference as a sign of gratitude.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Pop off. And then everyone starts arguing. Kraus and Natsuhi are like, why is Battle of the Successor? There's nothing in the epitaph that says this chooses a successor. Meanwhile, the rest of siblings are like, no, Battler is the successor. We decided that whoever found the gold would be the successor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're like, we implicitly said that. That was the basis of all of our discussion, blah, blah, blah.
They kind of pull... Erica goes back to the guest house. Meanwhile, Battler is sort of pulled into a family meeting.
Yeah, so it ends up, with Battler, Erica, and all of the adults, like, in the room with the gold. Mm-hmm. Which I would like to point out, the only additional information that we get about where this place is Hideyoshi says it's cold.
Says there's no heating.
It's wet because the drippy sounds are still happening. We knew it was wet. And Hideyoshi also describes it as being in a ridiculous place.
Yeah.
I don't fucking know what that means.
I love Hideyoshi. But...
Hey.
So interestingly, I think real Battler, OG Battler, would probably step in and try and say at least something in the family conference. I think the reason Battler doesn't say anything here is because he's being controlled by Birdcastle. Birdcastle doesn't actually care about what the outcome of this family conference is. She cares about the fucking game, and this family conference, whatever happens with it, won't change the game massively. So she's just like, I'm not going to influence it. I'm not going to make Battler do anything. That's my hypothesis as to why he doesn't say anything here.
Yeah, we kind of leave them, don't we, when they're going back into the mansion to have more discussions. And he's just like,
And then we have a very interesting discussion with Vigilia.
Mm. Yeah, so Battler's chatting with her. And basically, again, being like, there you go, Beatrice, you got what I wanted. I solved the epitaph. Why did you care?
And Vigilia shows up. Using a lot of red, which apparently she says that she thinks Beata would be fine with her using. Which is that Beata had nothing to gain or to lose.
Especially because, and she also says, the gold was hers to begin with.
Yeah, it was always her gold.
I wonder if this entire game is a test to see whether or not Battler can become the new head of the family.
They do, yeah, Battler basically goes on a big, thought journey where he's like, if she didn't gain anything from solving the epitaph, that means it was meaningless. And solving the epitaph is balanced on the other side by the epitaph murders happening, because one stops the other, which means that they're also meaningless. So what the fuck is her motive? To be something outside of all of that. Which I'm not sure necessarily follows, but...
Also, this is the point where Vigilia shoots down Battler culprit theory. Apparently Battler didn't kill anyone in any of the games, so RIP everyone who was on that ship. It's been sunk.
Yeah,
that's a shame. That would have been very interesting.
And also, Vigilia says that her goal was not to make someone experience fear or to have revenge.
Yeah, because Battler basically goes if her motivation, if it wasn't about winning the game, either has to be that the epitaph murders create a narrative that is beneficial. But it was because we have the red truths and we're seeing it from basically this meta world, it can't be that because we can see through those. It's either, or it's coincidence that the murders follow the epitaph, or the way that the epitaph murders were made to create constant fear in the people who were left around. Yeah. And that therefore the people who are left right till the end are like the true victims of whatever this whole scheme is, because they've been tortured by having all of these people die around them and then are being killed themselves. So he's like, oh, okay, it's me. I'm the person who's around at the end all the time. So Beatrice is trying to take revenge on me for something.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, ooh, that's cool. Yeah, that makes sense. Totally cool. Down with that. And Virgilia's like, no, she's not in it. She's not trying to take revenge.
We also get that she's not doing this for pleasure either.
Yeah. That rules out a fucking ton of stuff.
And this is very helpful for if you want to figure out motivations behind all this.
I have three things that I have written down that don't fit into any of those categories. Because, like, Battler still thinks that the game does mean something to Beatrice, and that it is linked with something she wants from Battler, or something to do with him. And so I was like, it seems counterintuitive to what's been going on, but is for some reason this a plan by Beatrice to save somebody? Like, is this saving Battler somehow and changing the course of his life from this point onward? Or
it's very funny if she is, because he's died in every other game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or I also wondered if this is less to do with Battler himself and more to do with us, the player character, and this is something that we are being particularly shown, and that Beatrice wants something from us. Don't fucking know what it would be. But yeah, I think he's right in that like, he talks about it like, oh, you know, when you play rock, paper, scissors or another game of kind of basically chance like that, it's less about who wins and more about like betting and like the game around the game, like the meta stuff. And he's like, I think this is more about that.
Reminder of our original theory where Beatrice was just doing it to entertain herself.
I mean, she did explicitly fucking say that. I think that, like, I don't know whether the murders weren't for pleasure.
It wasn't for pleasure.
Okay. So,
but I think that's her cover, at least for Lambda and Burncastle.
Yes.
So
she's raising the difficulty of her own objective, which reminds me of all the conversation that we had about the odds and miracles and stuff. And is it actually that she's trying to perform some insane ritual, like insane miracle, and that she has to like make the odds extremely high
or low, or whatever. Yeah,
they have to be extreme odds, because that's the only way she's going to be able to pull off a miracle of that caliber. And the fuck is the miracle? And is it making Battler clever enough to be the head of the Nishiromiya family?
Is it to resurrect Kinzo?
Is it to resurrect Kinzo? Is it to resurrect herself?
Is it to save Asumu from the past?
Is it to keep Anjo?
Well,
okay.
We know it has something to do with Battler's sin.
Yeah. I would love to know what that is.
Battler 2.
Battler's sin is there's two of them.
Battler killed Battler 2. This is Battler 2. Battler killed Battler Prime. Took his place.
Oh, and doesn't remember because he has all of Battler Prime's memories.
Yes.
Solved.
Easy, mate. And it doesn't go against any of Nox's principles, so fuck you.
I might argue that science-y cloning of an entire person in 1986 might be slightly scientific.
No, it's not cloning, it's just his older brother, who's also called Battler.
Oh, right, I see. What are we going to call this second one? Just go Battler again.
Yeah, because Battler Prime's a fucking knobhead, so we're just going to try again.
This is better Battler.
Battler 2, yeah.
Build a better Battler.
Meta Battler.
One of the Battlers was Natsui's son, and the other one isn't.
I hate this.
Oh, I had a question actually, Courtney, right? I've looked at the Red Truths for the discussion about Battler's sin and who his mother was and stuff. Yeah. And so obviously the truth that Battler is trying to say that he can't get out because it's not true in Red is it was from Ushirimiyo Asumu that that I was born or whatever. The one above that is a statement completely in Red that Beatrice said that was, it was from Ushira Asumu that Ushirimiyo Battler was born. And she said that whole thing. But he also, so I was like, oh, does that mean he's not Battler? But he also says, my name is Ushirimiyo Battler in Red. So I'm like, what the fuck is going on here?
There's two people called Ushirimiyo Battler. Ushirimi? Yeah. Fuck me.
Ushirimi.
I can't wait to do, like, one of the Ace Attorney games where we have, like, a bunch of, like European names and y'all can realise that I'm not, like, terrible at just pronouncing Japanese names. I just cannot pronounce anything.
All names.
The fact that I can say Natsui consistently, a miracle.
Yeah, I mean, Ryukishi and Ushirimiya are a bit like, nah, but you're trying.
One of the earliest episodes of this podcast, I call Jess Jez.
Did you?
Yeah! yeah, I just did that. I was like, Jez.
Sure.
We love that.
Is there anything else?
I don't have anything else to say about this reading.
Well, we got introduced to Erica. Fucking love Erica, as you guys know. As I said, Beatrice, my favorite character. Erica Furudo, the best written fictional character of all time.
I'm interested to see where we're going with it.
Yeah, we're going to get a lot more Erica content, as you can imagine.
I'm glad for that because she's fun. Like, more than anything, she's a fun character. And
she's also carrying the detective genre of the game on her back, which yes. I am a big fan of.
Lord, if we don't need a bit of fun.
She's so much more competent than Battler. It's like, honestly, as you go through this episode, I just remember being like, wow, Battler had so many things he could have done to properly solve this and did none of them.
And he could have done them and then told us.
Yes.
What the fuck was he doing?
That would have been nice.
And I've got to go and fucking try and solve the epitaph now.
Bloody hell.
I feel like you've made some good progress.
Yeah, I feel like between us, we've got some leads, certainly now.
Can I perhaps request another Red Truth from you, Corny? Oh. Do we know every name that Kinzo is referred to by? We know every name that Kinzo is referred to by. Okay.
We know every name that Kinzo is referred to by.
Fuck, okay. That's fine. That's good. That just helps. Because...
Yeah, I don't suppose it could be, like, something to do with Goldsmith, could it? Because that's his, like, witch name.
Yeah, it just doesn't have six letters. That's the thing. None of his name has six
letters.
None
of them do.
Even no matter how I butch the pronunciation.
I'm gonna say this. You're looking for a five-letter word for the third one.
Okay. Well, then.
I think it's Kinzo, yeah.
Or Gold or Smith.
Gold is four letters.
Fuck!
Gold with a U.
We've been here before. We've done this exact thing before.
Thank you for listening to Hidden Tea Party. All of our socials will be in the description.
All our socials in the description. Next time, we will be reading as far as... we'll be reading as far as and including... I should be clearer on these. Chapter 10, The Morning of Tragedy.
Goldsmith.
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 Goldsmith. Hi, everyone.
Actually, I have a question. So Umineko is problematic. How problematic is it compared to James Bond?
Oh my god.
Scale of 1 to 10.
Oh my god. Okay, so actually what we have is we have the patented scientific scum spectrum for smarm, cultural insensitivity, unprovoked violence, and misogyny, which is you rate all Bond movies out of 7. on these four topics. So in terms of Smarm, okay. Umineko fucking absolutely a 7 out of 7 because that bitch is just like knows so much better than you and is constantly gloating about it as a piece of media. Cultural sensitivity. I feel like maybe a 3. On
I didn't think there was any.
It's not.
What's the cultural sensitivity?
I don't know. Just rancid vibes.
Just rancid vibes. You can't give it a 3 on vibes.
Okay, maybe a 1 then. Maybe a 1. I feel like
you're gonna go 1 for aesthetic descriptions of Christianity.
I'm gonna go a 1 for complete absence of people of color.
Okay, yeah, that works.
So culture and sensitivity, unprovoked violence. Well, that's definitely a 7. If only
I would argue that maybe a lot of the violence is provoked, but yes, I like
there is a lot of provoked violence. There is also just like a lot of Maria being horribly murdered that just didn't need to happen. Yeah. And for misogyny, I will be giving it a 0 because it is a girl boss piece of media. As we are all fully aware, as Courtney has explained many times, it is a 0. This has been the Kill James Bond section of Hidden Tea Party. Shout out to Abigail Thorne if you're listening. I'm so sorry. Lovely. Well, I'm glad to have a little after credit sequence that I can put at the end of this episode.
Yeah.
I'm gonna
scum scale with
Umineko. A hidden tea party in our hidden tea party, if you
wait. Want. We're gonna have to come up with this when we finish Umineko. We'll come up with our own scale.
Maybe.
Okay.
The non scale.
The non scale.
I'm stopping recording.
Okay.
Thank you and good night.
Bye.